Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto hosting from the Dog Works Radio Network in Willow, Alaska. And on the line is the Gypsy Musher himself, Hugh Neff. Hugh, how's it going?
Great, man. We're hanging out here at my buddy Dave Shear's house over on Scott Lake outside of Wasilla. Walter is getting me to give him a little morning rub down as usual. And I'm here with my buddy Scott, who's been visiting from Dutch Harbor. I met Scott at the end of the Iditarod last year in Nome, and he showed up at my place about a week ago, and he said, "Hey, it's my 50th birthday. I wanted to hang out with you." And I'm like, "Sure, no problem." And since then, he's basically helped me finish up a lot of the house projects, and the house is looking good, and we're ready for the winter, that's for sure.
Very cool. I know you're heading over to Europe tomorrow afternoon, morning. We're going to talk about that in just a second, but introduce Scott to us, and maybe you can say a few words about where he's from. I'm sure a lot of people know the term Dutch Harbor if they watch Deadliest Catch on Discovery Channel.
Yeah, my name's Scott McLean. I work on the Deadliest Catch boats as they come into port. For Rapidema, I do welding and hydraulics and do engine room work, and I can fix anything. You just tell me what to fix, and I'll fix it.
So, Scott, what is it like to live out there in the middle of the ocean, pretty much away from everybody? How is that, and how do you get along out there?
I own a boat and a permit there for Bristol Bay Salmon, so I'm a skipper, owner, operator, and we just done 6 weeks out in the river. Offloading to the tenders, which are the deadliest catch boats in the winter. And it's peaceful, hard work, a lot of weather. You have to keep an eye out so you do not end up dying out there. So the weather's like the biggest thing out there to keep an eye on when you're in a 32-foot boat with 5,000 pounds on it of salmon.
So how far, Scott, is that in terms of miles from the mainland or from Anchorage by air?
Anchorage by air is 800 miles, just shy of it. And then where I fish my own boat and permit is half that, 350 miles there out of South Naknek, Alaska.
And what's the weather like in the summer and what's it like in the winter?
In the winter, it's always snowing and raining. It depends on which way the wind's blowing. If we get a Pineapple Express out of Hawaii, it's raining. And then what'll turn around and come from Siberia across the Bering Sea, it'll freeze. And then you got freezing rain and snow piled up on the ice. So it gets treacherous in the winter. And then Bristol Bay, there's nothing like the summer in Alaska. It just doesn't matter. Anywhere you're at in Alaska, you need to be here in the summertime with the bugs.
Of course, of course. So, Hugh, how did you meet up with Scott, and what in the world does he know about mushing living out there pretty much on an island in the middle of the ocean?
Well, to tell you the truth, when he showed up last week, there was a knock on the door, and somebody had left a message in the middle of the night saying, "Hey, it's your buddy from Nome," and I didn't really remember him that well. And so then he shows up at the door, and he comes up, and you imagine I'm having coffee at 7:30 in the morning. He comes up and he goes, "Hey, Hugh, how about a hug?" And I'm looking at this guy like, "Who are you again?" But then he reminded me that he's actually buddies with my friend from Hawaii, Dan, who is basically the guy that takes care of me and helped out a lot with us this year after the Iditarod. So we're looking forward to seeing Dan here in November. But, you know, it's the magical world of Alaska, dude. It's a huge place, but we really are interconnected here like no other state, that's for sure, I believe. And it's just been awesome hanging out with him. And, in fact, you're getting me all excited talking about Dutch Harbor because we're trying to figure out a way for me to possibly go there sometime in December and do a couple school talks and just check out where he works and everything. You know me, Robert, I love mushing and all that, but for me, the greatest love is Alaska and you can never get bored exploring Alaska.
Very cool. Hey, Scott, so what do you know about mushing? Obviously, you know enough to show up at the finish at Nome. I'm sure most people in Alaska know what that's all about, but what do you know about the sport in general?
What I know about the sport in general is the dog. I worry about the dog, what he eats, what he sleeps in, and making sure he's clean, the around where he's tied up clean, and popping out the houses after a snow blizzard in Nome, they'll get pushed out through the snow, and the snow will pack up their houses, and you have to pop them out of the ice, and I learned how to do that very quickly.
Very cool. Have you been on a sled before, Scott, or are you just kind of a fan that wants to be involved now that you show up at Hugh's place, and of course I'm sure he's given you a ride or two on the ATV?
Yes, that's what I needed to have, was the ride on the ATV first, learn the dogs' names, feed them, pick up after them, and then try and learn where they go in the lineup on the line. But I ended up doing a lot of work around the house, so I only got 2 days of actually working with the dogs, and then I was put to work fixing stuff.
And hunting.
Oh, yeah, I did take off and go hunting.
Did you get anything?
I missed mine by about 10 minutes. Somebody coming the other way got him.
Hey, that's how it works.
Year.
I guess that's why they call it hunting and not necessarily catching, huh?
Right. I'm used to catching. I'm an only child, so you can be first after me.
Very cool. So, Scott, are you going to be involved?
On the sea ice, though, pretty much.
Yeah.
Giving those kid rides.
Yeah. That's how we met, out on the sea ice. Hugh gave us a ride on the sled out on the sea ice after the Iditarod, and that's how I met him. I helped hook up the dogs.
Very cool. Are you going to be involved with the dogs while Hugh is in Europe?
No, I actually have to go on another job. I'm going to go probably around the United States just as much as he's going to Europe.
Very cool. So in the segue with that, Hugh, I know you're heading out tomorrow to do your European tour. I believe you're heading over to Germany, possibly France. Is that right?
No, the schedule is Germany, Netherlands, England, and Luxembourg, and then back to Germany.
Wow.
Could be about 2 weeks.
So 2 weeks. You're heading over for 2 weeks, and, of course, Walter the Wonder Dog is heading over there with you. How does for new listeners, Hugh, how does this whole thing get set up, and how do you coordinate such a trip in 2 weeks, and how does that work out traveling all over the place like that with a dog in tow? Are there any restrictions that, you know, like Hawaii, they have a very strict quarantine period for dogs. Is it any different for Walter coming along?
Well, every country's different. You have to have your vet checks. I had my local vet, and now I'm actually getting ready after this show to go and meet with the state vet to have her. We have to have a bunch of forms and stuff filled out. But every country's different. How this all started was just passion, really. People followed me in races. There was a German documentary done by ARD, which is basically German's BBC or CNN of Germany. And it was a 3-day special they had on TV there. So I always laugh and tell people I'm the David Hasselhoff of dog mushing. I'm pretty much a nobody in Alaska, but you get me over in Europe, and everybody's like, oh, it's Hugh Neff. But more than myself, what they really want and what I enjoyed watching with my buddy Scott here this past week is they like me, hopefully a little bit. But what people like about me the most are my dogs. And if they want to hang out with me just to appreciate how amazing my dogs are, that makes my day. So even though I'm going to be doing talks at various places the next couple of weeks, Walter's definitely the star of the show. And it's been exciting promote not, you know, what I'm about, but what dogs are about. A lot of people come into the whole dog mushing scene wanting to be, you know, the great Iditarod champion or whatever. But for me, I never really wanted to be a dog mushing champion, dude. I always wanted to be a dog. You know that. You see the way I dress, how I live. So for me, it's a great way to connect my passion with Walter and with Alaska for folks over in Europe. So hopefully, you know, they're wise enough to get on up to Alaska and check out what it's all about. And having done all the my talks nightly in Tokyo this summer, it's just amazing how many tourists and folks that come into Alaska are not coming from L.A. or New York or Chicago. They're coming from Europe, man. I'd say close to, 40% of the people that are driving through Tok, Alaska, which is your first major city, are not necessarily Americans. They're Europeans and other parts of the world.
So is this your second or third trip over to Germany? I know you went, was it last year as well?
Yeah, this will be my third. And I love doing it. It's the first time that we're really getting, more into other countries in Europe. And, as time goes on, I'm getting more and more demand for this, these shows and presentations. And, I love putting on a good time. I love making people laugh. A lot of what the audience enjoys isn't necessarily the whole dog mushing scene as far as the racing goes. It's just the day-to-day living. They want to hear about the animal encounters, strange things that have happened on the trail. They want to know about the native lifestyle. Over in Europe, the Indian is a very highly revered person. And so I just enjoy showing them not only about the beauty of dog mushing, but just the day-to-day lifestyle. And it's a lot of work, and they appreciate what we have over here, because you talk to any person from Europe, and they're just blown away by the open spaces that we enjoy here in Alaska.
Everything is so crowded over there. It's old and crowded and much different than what we have right here. Our closest neighbors are sometimes miles away, where they're on top of each other. When you head to the Netherlands, have you been there before? And I'm sure to Luxembourg and, of course, England as well. Have you visited any of those places?
I've driven through Luxembourg. I've seen a lot of movies that were in London. But Netherlands, I actually have a lot of friends that come to Tok every year and stay with a neighbor of mine who has a bed and breakfast. So I'm looking forward to seeing them. I find that, I'm actually sort of a European mutt like many Americans. I'm part German, part French, part Dutch, and what have you, part Irish. But anyhow, you go over there and you sort of try to see what part of you as a person comes from this area of the world. And so for me, the Dutch are fascinating people, just not only their language, but, you watch the Winter Olympics, and for such a small country, they dominated there for the first week or two as far as in the medal count. So they're very athletic people, too, similar to, Germans or the Norwegians, what have you, the Swedish. But everywhere I go, man, and my whole life is about exploring, so I'm really looking into checking out the history of everything. That being said, part of the reason I have Walter with me is to make sure that my host families and people I'm going to be visiting get me where I want to be, and that's out in the woods, getting some exercise and enjoying the landscape there. I've been all over the last few years, but wherever I go, the first thing I want to do is go explore the hills or the mountains in the area.
Very cool. So you're heading over for 2 weeks to Europe, and then I assume you'll be back towards the beginning of October. And, of course, that means really gearing up towards the winter season. I'm sure that you're out doing some fall training. We just mentioned off the air that's where I'm headed after we get off the air here. How's that working out? How do the dogs look?
Oh, they're great, dude. Really good. It's funny, I think you're a good buddy of mine, and I've talked to a lot of people through the web and what have you. And it's funny that last year was sort of, in many respects, a disappointing season for me, since I wasn't able to finish Iditarod and had a rough go out there. But considering I came in top three in the other two major races in Alaska, the Kobuk 440 and the Quest, besides the Cusco, which I didn't participate in, those are the major races up here year to year. For me to feel disappointed, I think that's actually a good thing. And it speaks to where I want to go. So talking of gearing up, I've been running hard the last couple of weeks every day with the dogs pretty much. Not necessarily because they need it, but because they want it. And the weather's changed. It's getting wet. I've got some girls coming into heat, got a lot of moose meat being fed to these guys, so they need to get out on the trail and let that energy out, or you're going to have you know, some issues. It'd be like a teacher, you know, leaving a box of ice cream in her room and then leaving for an hour and coming back and seeing how the kids are acting. These dogs have lots of energy, so I'm running them every day just to have them enjoy it. But when I go away for a while, they have a time to mellow out. I have people that will be running them while I'm gone. But while I travel, they're actually going to put weight back on. They need that time off for a little bit. But then when I'm in at the house, you know, I'm Captain Travel, and they know when I show up that we will be going places. So even though I'm going to be traveling a lot this fall, doing talks, you know, that's how I help to pay for racing and all that. When we're at the kennel, we're going to be out on the trails a lot this year. I don't know if I'm going to do too many preliminary races this year, but I plan on doing some major camping with these guys. The major trip that we've got planned so far is middle of December. Right before Christmas, we're going to head to Dawson City from Tope, and that's going to be a fun little trip, that's for sure. A lot of young dogs, and they could really use the experience.
When we were speaking with Scott, you guys said that you were getting the house up in ship shape, and with that, we've been kind of carrying on with your story the last few shows about what's going on there. We talked about saunas and hot tubs and the whole nine yards, trying to make it into a little bit of a bed and breakfast place for your mushing visitors. What have you guys worked on in the last couple of weeks now that you've had a handy guy like Scott around?
Well, we got the stoves are all set up. The piping is ready to go. We put in flooring in the living room. We've got basically everything set up and ready to go. Sauna's done. Haven't got the hot tub yet, but, you know, beggars can't be choosers. I'll take what I can get. I wasn't going to ask him to make a hot tub, too. But, you know, I'm 47 now. Scott's 50. As you get older, you need to really take a big look at the view of not, you know, this year, but what you want to do the rest of your trip. And I want to be doing as much traveling with dogs 30 years from now as I am now. And that's why I'm getting stuff that will be good for my muscles and to recuperate when we do these runs. People don't realize it's fun out there, but it takes a lot on your body. And considering how many races I do every year, it's definitely a struggle that I'll deal with. But you know what? If it's going to keep me healthier in the long run, then it's more than worth it.
Well, you know, I'm heading up your way early October. I'm looking forward to using that sauna if it's ready by then.
Oh, yeah, man. And there's definitely something we haven't talked about, and I just want to give a big shout-out because I know – there might be a few mushers that listen in to this show every once in a while, and I just want to give a great, you know, take my cap off and all that to Jeff King to sign up for the quest. I think there's a reason guys like Jeff are big, not heroes of mine, but I'd say a long-distance mentor. It's not like I hang out and talk with the guy that often, but I definitely respect his career and for a guy to go back and do the quest, which he doesn't really need to do, and it's been 25 years now, I think that's awesome. And I think hopefully some of these younger mushers will pay attention to what this guy is all about, because he definitely is pretty amazing history on the trail that he has done. And to have him back in the quest this year is going to be awesome.
Speaking of that, the last time I looked, it looked like 25 mushers had signed up already for the quest. It's still pretty early in terms of signups. What do you think about the field? Is it larger than it has been in the past? It seems to me that it's usually a much smaller field than it looks like it's going to be this year.
Yeah, we expected it to enlarge a little bit after what happened with the Iditarod Trail last year. I think people always are talking about how tough the quest is, the toughest race, but what we went through in Iditarod last year put that to shame. The quest can be a tough race if your dog team doesn't necessarily know where they're going. It's always nice to have some veterans in it. But I think it's going to grow even more. I wouldn't guess maybe 10, maybe 15 more mushers are going to sign up, hopefully. I hope to sign up once I have enough money raised so I can sign up probably when I get back in October. Like I always tell people, just because I'm famous doesn't mean I'm rich. I the nickel and dime in the screen from day one, and that's why I think people sort of enjoy following what I do, because they realize that it's what my whole life is about. So I'll definitely be signing up here in a little bit, and I definitely think I know Nick Petit was mentioning that he was going to sign up, and I've been trying to talk Timmy Osmar into it, a good buddy of mine who won the Quest. So I think it's just good for me. I get a chuckle out of it seeing these Iditarodders sign up for it that have never done before, because it makes them have that kid spirit that they're, you know, the Iditarod, you don't see as much of the adventurous spirit, I think, as you do in the Quest, because it's more of a business-like type race. Where in the Quest, there's just this a little bit more magical as far as Dawson City and the great unknown out there when you have to carry such large loads of supplies because the distances are a little bit longer. So I definitely think this year's Quest is going to be really, really fun to watch.
Let's talk just a second about that, Hugh. You had mentioned costing money to run these races. You know, I think a lot of fans don't have any idea what it costs to just enter the race. I know the Iditarod last year was $3,500, and I think the Quest, is it $2,000 or $2,500?
No, the Iditarod's $3,000. The Quest is $2,000. What people have to realize, and it's not really talked about, I don't know why it isn't, but it should be, that this isn't like the NFL or baseball or basketball, where you have teams that are allocated the same amount of money and the players are, you know, have certain rights and all that, and they're in unions and what have you. The Quest is, you know, every man for themselves. You could have a kid that can barely come up with the money to sign up for a race racing against multimillionaires that have been doing the race for 30-some-odd years. So when people watch these races, they have to realize that the people that tend to be in the front of the race year in, year out, there's a reason that they're up there, and they should be, because they're funded more. They have universities and scientists helping them out. There's a reason why these people are doing so well and performing so well. It's not just the dogs. It's their organizational fit and how they operate. And for me, it's neat to watch as the years go by, the up-and-coming new kids that are just, you know, doing most of all the chores and a lot of the work by themselves, because they're the ones that we all used to be like when the dream first started. And as an older musher now, I try to remember what my roots are and how it all started. And though things don't go the way I want them to sometimes, you just have to believe and persevere and realize that things are tough sometimes, but there's always another hills to conquer. And well, you have to enjoy what you do. It isn't about the glory at the end of the race. It's about just the beauty of the journey itself.
That's right. I mean, obviously there can only be one winner. And if you have a field of 60 mushers in Iditarod or 25 or 30 in the Quest, you guys are still running the same race. And once you get out there, it really doesn't matter how much money you have. It depends on what's in those drop bags and what you've done to prepare to get there. So I think it's pretty even once you're out there. Is that right?
Definitely the dogs with more experience help. But there are races where, believe me, some of the wealthier mushers have friends at pretty much every checkpoint, whether they're flying planes or what have you. So it's always going to be like that, though, and you just got to stay focused on what you're all about. But to tell you the truth, what I'm all about, dude, and I was thinking about this last week, and I know that we have a dog mushing Hall of Fame in Alaska. I was wondering, is there actually a dog Hall of Fame in Alaska?
I don't believe there is. I think we revere the people much more than the dogs, and I think that that's a sad state of affairs. I think we need to revere the dogs a little bit more. There's a heck of a lot of dogs out there besides Balto and Togo out there.
I think it's embarrassing, man. It's pathetic. I cannot believe there's not a dog museum for racing, or not even for racing, just for Alaskan, the history of Alaska. I think they want to talk about, you know, dog mushing being the state sport, but it's so much more than that, and it's really about the dogs. We should start a petition or something, but I bet you it would be a pretty fancy museum, and tourists would love it if there's a smart businessmen out there that probably should look into it.
Yeah, I mean, it could go right in connection with the Dog Mushing Hall of Fame. I guess that's right there near Reddingtonville in Kinnick, right?
Yeah, we might not know what we're talking about. There might happen to already be a Dog Hall of Fame, but if there isn't, we really, as Alaskans, should all gather together and, you know, don't make it super difficult for the dogs even to get in there, because when you're talking dogs and, you know, honoring them, it's not just the dog you're honoring, what the dog has accomplished, though. I think there's just a lot of amazing stories out there that need to be shared more about the dogs themselves and not about how great this certain person is at being a dog whisperer. As you get older, you realize that the best part about being a musher is there's always something new to learn. So the more we can learn about each other's dogs, I think it would help us all out in the long run, because these dogs, you know, they're teaching us as much as we're teaching them.
You know, I think what did help in terms of that was that book that came out a year or so ago, the one Born to Run, that was all about the dogs. I don't think it had any pictures of us human mushers. It was all about the dogs and where they came from and how many miles they've done. And it wasn't just all lead dogs, was it?
No. I had a bunch of dogs in there. That was by Albert Lewis, a really great, amazing book. I wish I could afford to buy one. But it's well worth the price, because you're seeing some of the prettiest pictures of animals that I've ever seen in any type of book, really. Walter's in it, and then I had Amigo and Kotzebue, and some of my puppies are in it. Got a great new boy pup, by the way, dude, named Stevie Ray, 3-year-old. He's just, some dogs are just really like to bark, you know, before you take off, and they don't pull at all, and they're just being goofballs. But this dog not only barks every time you stop, but he's barking half the time while you're running. And I remember Lance had a dog like that a couple of years ago, and dogs like that are just sort of funny because they just have so much energy. They're just, you know, like kids out there, and that energy really translates, I believe, to other members of the team. That's my biggest worry, dude, is when John gets back with my other dogs from Dai at the end of this month, I'm going to have a lot of energy in my yard. So if anybody wants to come visit and run some dogs first week of October, feel free to swing on by, because I'm going to be doing some major trips up on the Taylor Highway once all the hunters are gone.
So when you head back towards the beginning of October, is that pretty close to sled time, or do you still have quite a bit of time to wait?
It's up to Mother Nature. You know, we had snow last week. It didn't stick at all, but it snowed one night all night. Then, of course, now it's getting warm again, getting our Indian summer in. But typically mid-October, usually right around the week of Halloween is when we're usually getting on sleds. This year, though, I'm going to be doing talks down in Oregon and then in Park City, Utah with my buddy Neil Bolin and also Brent Sass and Mike Ellis. So that's going to be a lot of fun. So I'm going to be doing the first 3 weeks of October, I'll be running pretty, you know, consistently on a daily basis. But people realize that for any younger mushers that are trying to get any pointers in here, when you're doing anything really in the dog yard, you got to mix it up. You just can't be on a set schedule. This is just my viewpoint. I'm sure there are some more military-like mushers that have everything regimented out. But for me, if you want to have a good spirit in the yard and keep the dogs from getting bored of what they're doing, I'm always mixing up my feeding schedule as well as my runs. And just keeping it light and happy in training. Training shouldn't be all about, you know, everything has to be a certain way. You have to sort of go with the flow and take it easy on your main leaders. They don't need to be up and lead the whole time in training season. That's the time when you should be looking for other leaders too. So in my training runs a lot now, I'll stop every 5 minutes. And Scott, you could say something about this. I was out there switching out dogs.
Yeah, as the dogs, obviously it's warmer out. The dogs are going to start sweating right away. I mean, they're already warm when we start, and I get it. They got fur, we don't. And they're going to do a lot of the running. They start really kicking it up when we get ready. I have to sit on the bike with the brake on. But once we go, we try and hit a mud puddle, get everybody cooled off, and then he will walk up and switch a couple people out or whatever. And take back off again. And then I was trying to get video, so I'd try and take off and get video. And then it was just, you know, we just changed it up, and the dogs would lay down the puddle, cool off, and then all of a sudden barking would start, and away we go again.
Hey, tell them your story about trying to put the harness on.
Crazy.
Tell them hey, Robert, I gave this guy the smallest dog, this John Baker dog, to put a harness on. And you remember the first time you ever tried to put a harness on your dog.
Oh, yeah.
It was fun.
Anyway, I'm not too real hip in the morning, so I'm just getting my act together, and I got other things on my mind, and he's telling me to go get the two dogs in heat. Well, I just let the door open, so they're running around like crazy.
Luckily, she came right, didn't they?
Yeah, so he can catch her. Anyway, he gives me the harness and Diomede, and I chase her all over the yard. I get the harness on kind of crisscross, and she's just going crazy. And I finally got it on her, and you almost had to call 911 because I was having a heart attack trying to get
she's
it on her.
Heavy. People don't realize these dogs just aren't sitting there on the couch waiting for you to put this dainty little, you know, sweater on them or something. They're lunging at you and jumping in the air. That's the beauty of dog mushing. You know, it's all about the passion.
It is about the passion. You know, I'm very familiar with little Diomede. I remember her when I was up at your place. She is a little spitfire for sure. And it does take quite a bit of practice before you get real proficient at hooking up a 10 or 8 or 12 dog team in harness. I remember when I was out with you on Iditarod, I believe it was Bodie's first Iditarod, and trying to get booties on that crazy dog took forever when we were just standing there. He was hooked up to the truck. And I've put booties on thousands of dogs, and that dog, boy, he just did not want to accept those booties. And finally we got him on and on down the trail. But I know exactly what you're talking about, Scott. It can turn into a real chore if it's not something you're used to.
But dogs like that, what you really need to do is just consistent daily habits and just keep on doing it. People don't realize a dog like Bodie, that's a Hans God mix. Annie's his mom. Father is a dog named Tank from Hans. And anyhow, I bred Bodie with Little Diomede, and that's where we got Lester from, the brown dog that everybody loves to take pictures with. But a couple days ago, we just bred Diomede and Bodie again, because they give off some really nice-looking, fast-looking, almost like a wolf-type-looking black dogs with a lot of power that aren't too big either. I don't really like a leggy dog. I like a dog that has a lower center of gravity with a thick chest. But they're definitely a lot to handle, and those younger dogs, like I had my buddy John Savage and his wife Amanda are taking care of the dogs now while I'm gone, and they threw one of their dogs in the team, and he ended up looking, you know, like a very good dog, but my dogs obviously are all related to each other, so when anybody else tries to put a different dog into the team, it sort of stands out a little bit. So whenever I breed, I'm always trying to get dogs that fit in with the team. I don't really necessarily try to get dogs from other people, though I did, through my buddy Dave Shearer, got two nice leaders from for a rendezvous friend, James Wheeler, that are 5-year-old male dogs. You got to see them, Robert, and they turned out to be pretty nice so far.
Very cool. So, Hugh, we're just about out of time. I want to thank Scott for joining us today. And, Hugh, safe travels over to Europe. I'm sure you and I will hook up after you get back. And, like I said, I'll head up your way towards the beginning of October. Maybe we can talk some dogs when I head up your way.
Oh, it sounds awesome, dude. And to everybody in Europe, I'm really looking forward to seeing you all. And let's all appreciate Walter. He's a magical dog, and right now he's getting some rest on the couch next to us. But we're looking forward to seeing you all in a few days. Thanks again,
Very
Robert.
Cool. Take care, guys. Safe travels. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
All right. Goodbye.